Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Missouri author Jess Bowers. Her short fiction has appeared in the Portland Review, Cream City Review, ReDivider, Story Quarterly, the Indiana Review, Zone 3, Oye Review, and other journals. Her stories have won the Winter Anthology Prize and Laurel Review's Midwest Short Fiction Contest. Her debut collection, Horse Show, published by Santa Fe Writers Project, will be released on April 9th. Today I'll be reading her story, Granddad Swam. But first, here's my interview with Jess, which was recorded on March 13th of this year. I'd like to welcome Jess Bowers to the podcast. How are you today, Jess?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. It's sunny out here in Missouri. I got my coffee.
Excellent. So you're in Missouri, and we're going to be talking about your new book, Horse Show, which Madison Smart Bell calls highly original, quirky, fascinating, easy to read, and hard to forget. And I could not agree with him more. I really enjoyed this book, and I'm excited to have this chance to talk to you about it. From the press packet that you sent, this is your museum of equine oddities that you're presenting us in this book. And it's just a fascinating historical look at the role that horses have played in our collective memories through popular culture and the military and entertainment. They really served so many purposes in our culture, in our history. Before we get into talking about the book and the stories, why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey into becoming a writer?
I was kind of fortunate growing up in that my dad was trying to be a poet. He was a sports journalist for money. So there was always sort of a general kind of culture of writing and reading around the house. I had access to all his books from grad school at a very young age, for better or for worse. And so, you know, there was always sort of the sense that you should be writing something because dad was always writing something, whether it was a column or a poem. So yeah, from a very young age, I would try to write things. And then from there, went to Goucher for my bachelor's in creative writing, then Hollins for a master's in creative writing, then University of Missouri for a PhD in creative writing, because I just really want to do this as well as I can. And telling stories is just, it's always obsessed me. It's my way of understanding the world and making sense of the world. And so, yeah, I've always written, and it feels like something I need to do. So
yeah,
I think a lot of writers feel that way.
Yeah, I think that's true of everyone who's been on this podcast.
Yeah.
So you are now teaching in academia, right?
I am. I'm an associate professor of English and Humanities at Maryville here in St. Louis. I run the creative writing program, which is really fun. We also have the poet Dana Levin. And so, yeah, fiction and talking about fiction and encouraging people to write fiction, it's a huge part of my day-to-day life as well. So that's worked out nicely, you know, to be able to combine those passions and monetize it in some way. I think academia has given me the research acumen that I needed to write this book in particular. I really enjoy being around young writers and encouraging them too.
Yeah, I think that may, you know, from what people tell me who are writers, you know, working in academia, that's one of the best parts of it is that, you know, you learn from your students. That, you know, that's probably the biggest benefit of all, I would imagine. So let's talk about your early beginnings. You grew up in York, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
You have a very unique relationship to the world of horses, you know, more than most of us. And, and yeah, so maybe if you could tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up with horses.
Well, interestingly, my family didn't own horses. I'm the only equestrian in my entire family.
Ah, okay.
What happened was when I was around two, I realized that dinosaurs are extinct. And so I was never going to be able to own one and ride one and be with one in the way that I wanted to. And I, for some reason, I think that transferred to horses because I was like, okay, here's a large animal that you can ride. And of course, My Little Pony played a role as well, right? And so I was just sort of incorrigible about this. I wanted to ride horses. So finally, my parents made that happen, which was surprising in retrospect, because I, you know, like I said, no one else in my family rides, and I had childhood epilepsy. I think mom figured that if I had a helmet on, I was okay. And in York, Pennsylvania, it's very much horse country around there. Lots of fox hunting, lots of eventing, lots of trail riding. And I was very fortunate to learn how to ride from a woman named Ann Wagner, who was very old school. She looked like she stepped out of the 1930s. She instilled in us barn rats, right? Because, you know, when you have a barn, it kind of collects girls, right? It's like a magnet. And she was very passionate about making sure that we didn't just know how to ride, that we knew everything about having to take care of the horses. And I just always loved that, right? And dreamed and dreamed and dreamed and planned that someday I would have my own horse. And then when I was 27 in grad school, that's when I met my first horse, Billy, and when I was in a financial position to finally do it. But that was after, you know, a couple decades of riding other people's horses. And it was much more of a sort of rough and tumble upbringing. Like, I don't show, which is ironic because my book's called Horse Show. I don't show. I just love to be around them, and I love the history of it all. And yeah, it's like writing. It's a huge part of my life and always has been. So it made sense eventually to combine the two and write about horses finally.
And you dedicate the book to your first horse, Billy, I noticed, who carried me. I love that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I want to try to get to as many things as possible in the hour that we have. But one of the things that I found really fascinating about this, it's an unusual collection in that it's really kind of a hybrid of nonfiction and fiction, I would say. I mean, you've done extensive research on so many of these, you know, historical horses from history, you could have called this, right?
Yeah.
And what we learn in reading this book is that, you know, they're really kind of the unsung heroes of not just our culture, but in this case, it's mainly American culture, but, you know, it's throughout the world. Horses have figured largely into the lives of men and women. So, but I love how much detail you've gone into in your research. And in some cases, you've kind of blended, I could see, like in one story in particular, shooting a mule. I feel like you've taken the basic outline of the history and you've embellished that. You've created characters and created a world in which this incident may have taken place. And and that I find as a reader just extraordinary.
Oh, thanks.
Because you've, you know, made a point of kind of blending fact and fiction. I wanted to talk about the concept first, because it's such a clear idea, you know, for a collection. Is it something that you had been pondering, like from way back, thinking, I want to put a book together about horses? Was that something that you had in mind at the beginning, or did that kind of occur later on?
It does have this thematic cohesion that I think belies its origin story. So for a long time, I didn't write about horses at all. And part of it was just a stubborn, childish rejection of write what you know. and then part of it was sort of this knee-jerk reflexive reaction against so much animal fiction, right? I think that sometimes the genre has a tendency to be saccharine, anthropomorphic, you know, skew toward young adult, which isn't what I do. And yeah, so I was nervous about it. And my friend sent me Shooting a Mule, it's interesting that you mentioned that because that's actually the first story I wrote. My friend sent me that photograph. I have some very good friends who know what I'm into and what will, because I've always been fascinated by photographic and film history. And so she had sent me this without any provenance or information. And then I went from there. And, you know, as you said, there were figures in these engravings that I found in Scientific American that accompanied the photograph that I wondered, you know, what did the people watching this think? Were they all in on executing this mule using instantaneous photography? Were they all in? And I thought to myself, surely there was one among them who was not. And so that's where the story sort of came from. And I think because it was a mule, it subconsciously gave me permission, because an equine, but it's not a horse. And yeah, that story was so well received that I just started to think about, okay, I wonder what else. I knew about Muybridge, right? Edward Muybridge's horse. And so that seemed a logical place to go next. And then from there, I just kept altering the rules as I went, right? I think sometimes as fiction writers, we create rules for ourselves, you know, that are artistically useful, and then you have to adapt as you go. And so the definition of what constituted a horse story expanded as the collection grew. But I really wanted everything to have a very clear tie to horses and spectacle. And so that's why it's called Horse Show, is because it's sort of all about, you know, the ways in which we like to look at these animals, but maybe don't necessarily have the respect that we should, or acknowledge this, you know, partnership that has endured for centuries. So that's kind of how, that's a roundabout answer to
explains a lot. And it's not news to most of us that, you know, horses have been exploited and you know, mistreated, not just as work animals, but for our entertainment pleasure. And that, you know, you go into that in stories about stunt horses in Hollywood, One Trick Pony, which is about the shooting of the film Jesse James, starring Henry Fonda and Tyrone Power as the James brothers. That's a remarkable accounting of what happened to that poor horse in the filming of that, where this, you know, middling director, is it Henry King, I think? Was determined to get this shot of the horse jumping off a cliff into a river. And, you know, the horse had better sense. And then they resorted to a really arcane thing, a machine used to throw animals into flea powder bath, you know, livestock, which was just brutal and horrible. Anyway, you know, whoever reads the story will get probably the most clear accounting of what actually happened. So just maybe talk about the research behind a story like that.
Oh, yeah. So it's interesting. A lot of people tell me that what I do is sort of this hybrid of fiction and nonfiction, which is always kind of funny to me, because I think it's historical fiction. But I guess that genre comes with certain assumptions that my collection doesn't, or my work doesn't do. I don't know. But with One Trick Pony, so I heard about this. Another thing, my friend slip me a copy of this movie. Okay. So different friend. Slip me a copy of this movie and said, you know, just see, he knew what I was working on. And he said, just see if there's anything here. And he mentioned that this was the movie that led to rules about animal action in Hollywood. So when I watched the film, it's not a good movie. But when you get to the stunt, it is so blatantly obvious that they just reused the footage and played it twice, that it just struck me as such an insult to the sacrifice. And also sort of just like, what are you doing? Like, filmically, what are you doing?
Yeah, because it was supposed to be two different horses that were doing this leap into the river.
Yeah, so. And then they ride off together, and and it actually resulted in the horse dying. And then they just, rather than I mean, to their credit, I guess, rather than do it again, they just reused the footage in the film. So they play it twice. Really weird postmodern moment in this otherwise straightforward film. So what I did with that one then, a little bit of research showed me that it took place at the Lake of the Ozarks, which is near here. Mm. And I really thought it was interesting. Lake of the Ozarks is such a tourist trap these days, but you know, it wasn't always. And so I was able from there to find out more about the shooting of the film, some details about sort of how they took over this town and really set up camp there. And then for the tilt shoot, the apparatus that they actually use, I had to look at like some old agricultural manuals. So there's a lot of it that, like, you know, I'll find in like some old article, oh, they used a tilt shoot, right? But it won't say anything about what a tilt shoot is or what a tilt shoot does or what it looks like. And then from there, I have to find out all about that. So I'm an obsessive researcher, which I think shows in the book. Yeah. People called it lapidary before as well, or meticulous. I want to know the truth. So, you know, the characters I extrapolate a lot. Like, I, of course, don't really know how any of those people felt or what they were thinking. So, you know, character is something that I construct based on the scant clues that I'm given. But yeah, a lot of it is sort of Frankensteining together the information I find with whatever I think is the emotional core of the story or whichever image I really want the reader to remember, right? Because I think short stories in particular can work so imagistically and leave you with that, you know, that image. So. Yeah,
the images are, you know, there are so many unforgettable images in this book. I mean, it really is something that, you know, it's going to stay with people once they've read it. There's no way you can unsee in your mind some of these things you described.
Sorry.
No. Sorry. I mean, this is what we read for, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but then you bring a poetry to this as well. You know, this is one of your other gifts, is that you're taking things of historic moment, but your use of language is just so skillful. I just pulled out some phrases. The gingerbread thin rail from the steeplechase story. In one story, you refer to news as filtering down like sun tea in a jar. There's a character with lean earthworm fingers. Flames sprouting out of a building in one of the stories, an infernal crown. And in that same story, the driver of this fire team horse, who takes loving care of this animal, puts his head to her belly every morning to listen to the secret aquarium of her gut. You know, when I read things like that, I have to make a note of them because, you know, that takes a particular kind of skill. So I had to stop and point some of those things out because this is the work that you're doing to embellish, you know, the history here, that anybody can, you know, recount a story from history, but not everybody can do what you do in the way that you do it. So, you know, I think it was necessary for me to mention that. But, you know, they are so atmospheric, these stories. And, you know, so many of them take place in the past, you know, like the late 1800s, the turn of the 20th century. And in many, you've sort of captured this voice, the way that people spoke and wrote in those years, which is quite different. As we know, you know, the English language has really evolved in so many crazy ways in the last couple of centuries. So there was a particular type of voice that when we read old books, you know, we're used to hearing. And you've captured that in many of these stories. And things like the first story, The Mammoth Horse, you know, that stands out as one of those kinds of stories, which is about a horse from history that stood 20 hands high and was 2,500 pounds and became a curiosity that this gentleman, Mr. Carter, who was once the Lion King and famous for his lions, it kind of fell out of favor and found this horse and thought he could kind of get back into the game with this horse. And then, you know, got the interest of people like P.T. Barnum. So, you know, we recognize some of the people in this story.
Oh, yeah.
But the, you know, the voice in this is very particular. So maybe if you could talk about, you know, how you were able to kind of channel that way of speaking and writing that we don't read in contemporary stuff anymore, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm a really big fan of old stuff. my PhD is primarily 19th century fiction. So I think I absorbed a lot of that diction through osmosis for something like The Mammoth Horse Waits. The other aspect for that particular story is, and I allude to this in another story, Granddad Swam, but my great-grandfather was a chicken raconteur, okay? And so I have all these old ads where he's like extolling the virtues of poultry in this really sort of inflated, over-the-top advertising patter, right? And so I think it's just sort of in me. But I've always loved like that mid-Atlantic accent, old advertisements that just have more copy than image. Watched a ton of Nick at Night as a kid, which I think you can tell in stories like of course, which is Mr. Ed. Again, I'm in love with language, and I want to be able to use as many colors in the vocabulary as I can. And so particularly when you're writing about the past, I think language is such a powerful tool to take you there, you know, whether I'm writing about the 1970s or the 1870s, right? It's such a powerful tool. The Mammoth Horse Waits was interesting because when it was originally published, the editor who first looked at it wanted all the adverbs gone. And I mean, I'm usually judicious with my adverbs, you know. I often feel like the presence of an adverb, take a look at that verb again. Maybe it could be different or stronger. But in that story, I had purposefully pumped up the adverbs and the, you know, because the narrator Rufus Welch, he's a raconteur. He's a salesman. He's a barker, you know. And the story is really framed as he's telling you this story, right? And so, yeah, I fought hard for my adverbs that time.
Good for you.
Yeah, that was the one and only time I fought hard for adverbs, because I was like, no, this is a voice. This is a intentional thing.
Yeah, clearly they were missing the point. Was intentional on your part, and it works so beautifully. And then the one that follows that, the second story, Two on a Horse, Two on a Horse is about the steeplechase ride at Coney Island, which I doubt still exists.
There's a modern version of it there. There's a German manufacturer that still makes these rides, now makes them to obviously modern safety specifications. But apparently they have one at Coney Island, and I want to go. Ride it.
Yeah, because I know what these are, but I can't recall ever actually having seen one at any of these arcades. But this is such an atmospheric story. It's so evocative, you know, and it's set probably like maybe just post-war, would you say?
It moves through time.
Yeah.
It moves through time. The concept formally for that story was the structure of the ride, right? There's these horses and, you know, it's like a carousel, you choose one. And so I liked the idea of the repetition of the ride, right? That it's doing this over and over and over again throughout the decades. And I also like the idea of, you know, different riders spending time with these mechanical horses and what that would be like. And so structurally, that's kind of where I started. Like, I want to visit each of these horses. And then the story sort of moves chronologically slowly through time. The first segment is, you know, kind of an early 20th century, like 1905 kind of deal. And then I would say, yeah, I end up roughly post-war, maybe post-World War II, even But yeah, that story was really fun to research because of all the Coney Island curiosities. And then also just the audacity of this ride. The more I found out about the Steeplechase ride, the more struck I was by how many amusements at Coney Island were purposefully designed to allow sort of more illicit things to happen, right? And so that, of course, got me thinking about, you know, what it must have been like to be a woman on this ride. What might it have been like to ride with someone you don't particularly want to ride with? Because women had to ride at side saddle, which was also absolutely insane to me. This is something that changed based on the photographs, right? Because I've looked at so many photographs of this thing. That does change at a certain point, you know, in I think the 30s or the 40s, they start riding it astride, right? I'm still fascinated by amusement parks and how dangerous they are and how nobody knows. So that was something that really kind of pushed me through that story.
And you bring in a character who's, is she a suffragist or who makes a point of her message is that these things are dangerous and really hazardous for women in more than just the physical dangers involved. And so, and so she kind of as a demonstration goes and rides one of these horses to bring attention to this. And that was an historical character as well, right? That you pulled into it. But then you end it with this character who's like a teenager who works in her dad's pizzeria in Coney Island. Pupette, who her nickname is Puppy, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And this is where, again, just to point out the skill that you have in taking these wonderful points from history and details and then weaving these human stories in of your own design, of your own making. And yeah, that's a lovely story.
Oh, thank you.
And
yeah, she's not real. I made her up.
Yeah, well, I assume so. And and she's a really memorable, sweet character. And, and you know, the way you bring it to that point in time and end with her character kind of brings it full circle in a way. But, you know, going back to structure, because, you know, you mentioned that earlier. This is something that I see repeated in the stories where, in this case, in Two on a Horse, you've structured it in the way you've described each particular horse, you know, the gray, the white, the brown, and their place in the steeplechase. There are different possibilities for the rider with each one of these. So people choose them based on whether they're thrill seekers or not.
You know,
right? Like the story One Trick Pony, you used the same kind of device with the movie, the clapperboard, with each scene that's being shot. And you do that, I think, with the Edward Muybridge story as well, with his setting up of those different shots that he's doing. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that form, I think, that's kind of comforting for a reader in a way. You know, it just makes me wonder in approaching these stories, is that something that you find helpful as a writer?
Yeah. Form for me is the most important thing, which, you know, puzzles and frustrates my fiction students, right? Because they come in and they're like, plot, character, plot, character. I'm like, no. We start with form. We start with form. And so oftentimes, you know, when I have an idea for a story, and it could be something, an idea could be something like a photograph or, you know, a scene from a movie or something. The very next question I ask myself is, what's the best form to tell this story in? What are the advantages and disadvantages of different forms I could choose? And I'm really into the idea of story form reflecting concrete objects. So, for example, like the steeplechase story, Two on a Horse, I really wanted that story to take the form of the ride. And so that's what I did, you know, which is kind of unconventional in terms of, you know, it doesn't necessarily follow like a linear Freytag triangle. It's more of like a, it's some bumps like on a dragon's back, right? Which is sort of what the ride is like too. But yeah, I always think about form, particularly when I'm dealing with a story that has something to do with repetition, right? Whether it's Two on a Horse where this ride is continually going, or One Trick Pony where they're dumping the horse once, but it looks like it's happening twice. I really do find like subheads very helpful in terms of orienting the reader in space or time. I think if they're used correctly, they don't get ignored, right? Sometimes subheaders can be glossed over by the reader, but I think if you signal early on in the story, like, hey, pay attention to these, this is important to what I'm doing here, that they can be really useful tools. And then the other thing that I do with form, which is perhaps a bit unusual, is that, again, I don't know if it's my background in poetry. I'm a really avid poetry reader, a really mediocre poetry writer, but I read it a lot, particularly before I write. I find reading poetry to be a great kind of jump starter for my own work. And like poets, I'm very concerned with form. So one of the things that I'll frequently do when I'm dealing with a formally complicated story is I'll print it out and then I'll lay it out on the floor and I will actually like look at the abstract form of the story. And, you know, again, this is another thing my students look at me like, that sounds insane. But I'm like, no, seriously, you can see sometimes the places where the story needs a little something, you know, or if the symmetry of a story is off, I feel like there should be a reason for that, right? Like, you know, there should be a reason why the form is doing that. And if there isn't, then make it more symmetrical. This is something that I think about a lot. And if you were to tear apart your copy of Horse Show and spread it out on the floor, I think you'd find some interesting symmetries there. But yeah, that's something I do a lot. And some form has always been my number one. That's where the fun is for me, is how am I telling the story? Not what, because, you know, I think, I firmly believe, and I tell my students this all the time too, I think you can write a short story about pretty much anything. Not much needs to happen per se in a short story. It's all in how it's being told. You know, that's where the magic really can be, I think. Yeah. So that's something that I think comes through in my work.
No, absolutely. There are stories that come to mind as you're describing your process there. And obviously you have a great love of the cinema, Hollywood, Hollywood history, television. In your bio, you say that you can be found watching too much television. And we see proof of that in the book, in a couple of the stories based on a true story, which is about the boy in the bubble that made for TV movie with John Travolta from the 70s, where a horse, the director decides he wants this horse in the story as a metaphor for the freedom that this poor boy in the bubble will never experience, right? And then the last story, which is about Mr. Ed, although the name is never mentioned in the story, which I love.
And, thanks. That was a rule I had for myself. I was like, okay, I'm not mentioning Mr. Ed. I'm not mentioning Wilbur Post. I'm not... I'm like, either you're on board or you're not.
Well, you know, for me, you know, for people of a certain age, we know immediately the cultural references. You know, unless you're a kid who's really into like, you know, TV Land kind of stuff, or you're not going to really. But I immediately was taken back in time. But what's so wonderful about what you do in this story is that you bring the main character, not Mr. Ed, but, you know, the architect, Wilbur, right? You bring his wife into the foreground in a way that the series didn't. She was this kind of neglected character, and you create the life of this woman who has who's clearly been neglected because of this, the introduction of this horse into their lives. And that's, you know, that's another example of where you've taken something, a familiar source, and you have created this other dimension to the story that doesn't exist in history in any way, but it makes this compelling story about the poor wife of this main character. So maybe you just talk about, you know, creating that life for her in that story.
Well, I mean, If you think about the premise of Mr. Ed from like an objective, realistic perspective, it's absolutely insane, right? I mean, it's absolutely nuts. First of all, people don't abandon horses typically, at least not in like suburban California. That's
Yeah,
not a
no.
thing. Throughout the entire show, right, of course, Mr. Ed was a big favorite of mine on The Nick at Night, also Francis the Talking Mule, but that's another story. And I remember as a kid even kind of keying into the idea that Carol Post was just always presented as this like nagging foil to the fun stuff that Ed and Wilbur want to do. You know, and it's like, if you take yourself out of the position that the show wants you to be in, which is on their side, right, and really look at it objectively, it's like, this woman's life is just it's awful. And so I love the idea of looking at things from a new perspective. I'm a huge Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan, which I think also shows in this book, particularly in stories like Based on a True Story, where I almost do this like DVD commentary kind of thing. I love looking at things and noticing the thing that I'm not supposed to notice. like, what's the thing you're not supposed to notice? And when it comes to Based on a True Story, again, a friend gave me the film, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, and said, you gotta watch this. Now he gave it to me like 20 years ago. And at the time, he was just like, this is an insane thing that I cannot believe got made. And then since then, of course, in the writing of that story, I've probably watched that movie more than anyone in the world has watched that movie. And the more you watch it, the more absurd the fact that there's a horse in the movie becomes. It's just so random that I'm always interested in sort of like, what was the choice behind the scenes? What motivated this completely random entertainment decision, right? So those are the types of things that keep me up at night.
Yeah, and there's a connection to One Trick Pony in that there is like this maverick director, quote unquote, who has this, you know, will not vision. Get this vision out of his, he has to have what he wants and causes all kinds of mayhem as a result. So
I love characters like that. Yeah. Now that you mention it, there's a lot of characters like that in this book, right? Mm. And particularly like recalcitrant men who have this, you know, it's like, this is how it's got to be. Why? Because it's what I want, you know? Sadly, I think that men like that really, you know, kind of run America and are very much put on pedestals in America. And so I love sort of exposing the ridiculousness of a vision like that, you know? It happens in Horse Waits too, this sort of idea of like, you think you have control over this situation, but you don't.
Right. These are beautifully evoked characters. And you do make some statements in these stories, not blatantly, but, you know, some of them carry a feminist sensibility or, you know, I mean, clearly with all of the ways that horses are depicted as having been abused in the stories, you're advocating on their behalf. But, you know, there's a story, Fred W. Loring and his mule, Evil Merodach, 48 hours before death, which... you're sort of describing the plight of the Native Americans and things that they had been promised and then this country reneged on. And, you know, and they're always painted as savages. But the truth behind these stories is that, you know, they're simply reacting to things that they were promised that were never given to them. And they're just advocating for themselves, basically. So,
And I particularly in that story, I enjoyed the irony of the title character, Fred Loring. He's a gay poet from the 19th century who could have been a contender, you know, like he was a real up and comer. But due to a failed love affair, ends up going west. Young man, you know, and is totally unequipped to do so. And I enjoyed the irony of you know, here is this young gay man who feels incredibly marginalized and unaccepted by 19th century masculine culture, and yet he's complicit in this sort of manifest destiny. Like the idea of like not seeing the intersectionality there is really interesting to me, that, you know, he couldn't extrapolate his own situation or his own self-loathing into kind of like, okay, what am I doing here? Right. And yeah, that story was really interesting to write in terms of just looking through all of Fred Loring's old papers and his writings and trying to piece together who this person was, even as, you know, if you look through his materials, intensely closeted, trying really hard not to go against the norm. And so I was interested in like the two kinds of exploitation in that story. Right. So, yeah, that was a fun one to write in a dark way.
But yeah, he really was just buying into the romantic notion of the Wild West. Someone who clearly was out of his element there, and no spoiler really, he ended up being killed. And you know, when the coach that he was riding in was raided, you know, by these Indians who were Native Americans, I should say, who were protesting. This was a way of protesting their having been mistreated.
Right.
But it was in his death, you know, his untimely death, that he became a famous poet, even though he was like a mediocre poet.
Yeah, he wasn't good.
Yeah, as you point out in the story.
Yeah, and I was interested too in all of the newspaper accounts, which I weave into the story, you know, in all the newspaper accounts of this massacre, right? The Wickenburg Massacre, it's called. I had to do quite a bit of digging to find anything that was at all sympathetic to the natives and their reasoning for doing this, right? Because, you know, it was an act of protest. It was, okay, you know, you're not doing things through the military as you promised you would, so we're going to go after some civilians and see if that forces your hand, right? And it was really interesting to kind of comb through all of that white savior manifest destiny rhetoric to try to figure out the truth. And then when I found out the truth, I of course sided more with the natives in terms of, okay, you know, yeah, they really didn't have any other options at that point. But yeah, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time and kind of became this martyr of this in a way that was really like, I'm interested in misplaced martyrdom too.
Yeah. And it was because he had been rejected by this William Chamberlain, who, you know, they were clearly romantically attached to each other, but because of the time and culture, they just could not be their true selves, live their true lives. And, and this was meant to be a slap in the face to this William Chamberlain.
I'm going west. And one of the things that I particularly found interesting about that period in sort of LGBTQ history is that it was a time when romantic friendship was much more the norm, right? Like men were more physically demonstrative with each other than they are, for instance, like post-World War One. And so I just thought about that could be a very confusing milieu for someone who is, you know, not heteronormative, right? Like, okay, how do I negotiate the camaraderie of the locker room or the, you know, boathouse and yet remain closeted or remain safe in that way? I did a lot of research on that, obviously, and really fascinating the ways in which, you know, people would try to negotiate their sexual identities. So, yeah, and that kind of comes back to the idea of like oppression of animals, oppression of people. I'm not a big fan of people controlling other beings. And I think that that shows throughout the collection.
Yeah. And it's easy to kind of pigeonhole abuse of animals in the kind of overview of this book. But you are clearly taking a harder look at oppression of all kinds against humans as well as animals. And it's handled in a subtle way, but it's very effective in how it puts those into, you know, a very clear perspective for the reader. Running out of time. One of my favorite stories is Lady the Mind Reading Mare. I love that. And her encounter with Joseph Banks Ryan of Duke University, who was considered the father of parapsychology. And he made it his mission to expose frauds, which would, you know, kind of delegitimize his own study, his own research. So he'd heard about this horse who could read minds, and he changed the environment to make sure that there was nothing underhanded going on. And he was completely sold on the idea that this horse had ESP.
Yes. He was.
Wow. Great story. Yeah, that blew my mind.
That story was a lot of fun to do because, again, I love the idea of this woman and her pet horse just kind of putting one over on the academic establishment. I also have always been fascinated by the idea that parapsychology was a legitimate academic discipline.
Right.
Like, what? You know? And so in that story, I had so much fun with like the combination of real scientific inquiry and, you know, being taken in by this. It really is a feat of horse training, right? What's impressive here is not that the horse is psychic. It's that the bond that this woman has with this animal is so strong that she can make people think it is. And there was something so fun about that. And the horse itself, Lady, lives to be 33, which is a really long time for a horse. And the things that people would ask this horse, all the transcripts in that story are real from conversations with the horse. So it's just so funny.
It's really suspenseful. And, you know, you can really get into the mind of Ryan, Dr. Ryan, and understand why he was so willing to accept that this horse really had a gift, you know, because you want to, because we all want to.
Want to, and saying anything less would have delegitimized everything that he was trying to do with people. Now, it was all ridiculous, you know, and of course, doesn't really amount to anything, but the seriousness with which he took the whole proceedings. And I love the idea of this scrappy housewife getting one over on this professor who thinks that he knows, but he can't see what's literally right in front of his face because he underestimates the woman, you know, he underestimates the bond that this woman and her animal have and what that can do, which, you know, again, I think is an undercurrent that runs through the whole book, right?
Yeah.
Underestimate beings.
Yes. You created a wonderful character in her, Mrs. Fonda. Yes. Mm-hmm. I want to go out talking about motion studies, which gives us a little window into something that most of us have had the experience of seeing in our lives. We may not know that it was Edward Muybridge who was the photographer who created these works, but motion studies set in like the late 1800s, around 1880 or so, goes into the story of Leland Stanford, who was a railway tycoon, also the person who founded Stanford University. But he, you know, had a keen interest in horses, racehorses. He had this racehorse originally called Wonder, whose name he changed to Occident. And he always had this theory that if you could capture it, you would see that horses at some point in their gallop, all four hooves are off of the ground and they're suspended in the air. And it just so happens that this photographer shows up one day, Edward Muybridge, who wants to photograph the horses. And it turns out that he proves that this is in fact the case. Mm-hmm. He's invented basically this way of photographing where he creates this array of cameras set to go off in rapid succession. And he proves that this is actually true. So those are images that anyone who's seen these short films, again, these are things that create such an impression, you know, you can immediately bring them to mind. I mean, he didn't do just horses. He did humans, you know, walking and engaged in various activities, other animals. So that must have been a fun one to work on too, I would think, right? You know, with all that you had available to you there.
Another focus of my PhD was film studies. And I think that that probably shows in the book as well. And I teach film as well at Maryville. So I've just always been so struck by those images. There's something really primal about them, both in regards to the depiction of the animal, but also in regards to the history of film, right? You know, because you've got Muybridge doing that, but then you also have Marie in France with his, he has like a chrono gun where you can shoot birds and get their motion. And yeah, so I've just always been fascinated by the idea that movies, which are now the dominant narrative art of our time, for better or for worse, started with an animal and started with a horse and started with a question about a horse. I was interested in that as the idea of an animal as the root of this thing that has become so much bigger than an animal. And I think that, yeah, in a way, that's the thesis of the book too, right? Like if you look back at these things that we take for granted, if you look back far enough, there's going to be a horse, you know? And that's true more often than not. And so motion studies was really fun, of course, looking through all the different images, right? Because some of the images, Muybridge got a little weird, you know? He's a little...
Yeah.
Dirty old man.
Yeah.
really is. And I was also fascinated too by, you know, there's that sort of Phineas Gage aspect to Muybridge's story where he had this carriage accident. And then after that, everything was different. You know, like accounts of his life seem to indicate that there was some sort of traumatic brain injury that changed his entire personality. And so I was really fascinated by that too. Like the idea that, well, the accident that led to him thinking in this way was also caused by a horse, you know? And so,
yeah,
just really interested in that. And the end of that story, I'm trying to do like a flicker, like a film strip kind of vibe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you structure it, yeah, as I had mentioned, shot by shot. And it's so memorable, as those images, you know, that Muybridge created, really. So kudos to you. This book is just enormously entertaining. It's already gotten amazing advance responses from, writers. You have some great blurbs on the cover. And this is being published by
Santa Fe Writers Project.
Santa Fe Writers Project. Okay. And it officially is being released on April 9th. And there's a book launch party in Baltimore on the 14th, right? That you have on your website.
Yeah.
April 14th.
Yeah. We're doing in Bethesda, Maryland on the 13th. We're having a launch party at the Abbasette Tower in Bethesda, Maryland. And then on the 14th, I'm in Baltimore reading at Atomic Books. So I'll be there reading and signing. And Atomic Books is an amazing bookstore. So if you're in the Baltimore area, you should, or even in York, you should come out.
Great. Yes. No, absolutely. And this episode is set to drop on Wednesday, April 3rd. So
great.
Get a little bit of advanced publicity there for you.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I'm you know, very excited to see this book out in the world and people enjoying it. And I know they will as much as I have. I highly recommend that they look for it when it comes out.
It, actually, if you go to Atomic Books website, you can even order a signed copy.
Cool.
I'll sign it when I'm there and they'll send it to you.
Excellent. Oh, well, this has been so much fun. Thank you, Jess, for taking time out of your day to join me here. I wish you all the best with Horse Show and everything else that follows.
Well, thank you so much. Short stories need more representation. And so just so glad to be a part of this podcast. And thank you for having me.
You can find links to some of Jess's stories, as well as information about upcoming events, on her website, jessbowers.org. And now we'll move on to the short story. Today I'll be reading Granddad Swam, which was first published in Oyer Review. So here it is, Granddad Swam,
by Jess Bowers.
We got a swimming pool one summer, like a television family. There were 8 of us out of diapers by the late 70s, 11 altogether, and each June our grandparents' farm became the family sleepaway camp, where we gave each other friction burns and sang rounds about poop. I was one of the middle boys, too small to pester Granddad about letting me drive the tractor, and too big to stay in the kitchen with Meemaw if it had been any other summer. But the heat wave brought us all sweating to the table, even Granddad, because Meemaw hoarded the oscillating fans. She liked to watch The Price is Right and Let's Make a Deal from the eye of her own tiny windstorm, where she chain-smoked and drank Diet Coke, while our littlest cousins tumbled in hand-me-down playpens. The 4 steel fans surrounding the table rattled ominously, especially the big Lasco that lopped off my older brother Jim's left pointer fingertip one summer. He swore that if you looked close, you could still see the blood, dried brown on the spinning blade. "Get back!" Meemaw barked whenever she caught us trying to switch it off and see. We should have been outside, but outside was an oven. Adams County hadn't seen rain since May. The yard was bone dry, fractured with deep cracks that twisted our ankles when we tried to run. The sun got so hot we could feel ourselves crisping, and the parched air was like a giant mosquito, sucking water from skin. Granddad never burnt. He baked, brown as a potato. At night, the flickering blue light of the zenith carved his features. We gathered around the TV on floor pillows, struggling through Lawrence Welk so we could beg to stay up for Carson. It all seemed so glamorous to us, even the bubbles, as if the bubbles blown in Hollywood were somehow shinier and longer-lasting than the ones we made with Meemaw's dish soap. Out there, they still had water to waste. Cameras luxuriously panned across overflowing swimming pools. The Brady Bunch Variety Hour even employed scuba cameramen to follow the leggy blue flutter of the show's 2 in-house synchronized swimming troupes, who performed their weekly water ballet in a special onstage pool while Florence Henderson cooed, "Love to love you, baby," under a hypnotically rotating disco ball. It got to all of us after a while, but it got to Granddad most of all. Our granddad was the eldest son of a once-thriving Pennsylvania poultry dynasty. He and his siblings grew up in the hot dust of the henhouse, passing eggs over candles to spot the embryos glowing orange within. Pamphlets and advertisements from this period tout the meaty breasts of our family's famous hand-raised white leghorns and barred rocks. Granddad was meant to take over the hatchery when he turned 18, so he ran the books all through high school. There are pictures of him poring over ledgers, inspecting incubators with a solemn, supervisory air. But he ended up going to Korea when his twin brother enlisted. By the time he returned, brotherless, to claim his feathery destiny, Purdue had bought out most of the local poultry concerns. The spring chick sale, which once attracted a mob of folks wanting to fill cardboard boxes with peeps, dwindled until it was just a handful of mothers wanting dyed chicks for their kids' Easter baskets. After Purdue, he always intoned the word solemnly like it was the name of a war. Granddad had to scale back the operation. He hatched just 30 dozen chicks one year, then 10 dozen the next, until only a small flock remained for scrambled eggs and chicken dinners. The big henhouse became a small engine repair shop, and he started fixing vacuum cleaners and lawnmowers for the neighbors. Our grandparents had lived that way for as long as I could remember, whiling away their days with grandbabies and poorly oiled machines. But here's the thing. Granddad had been born in that big old farmhouse, but he wouldn't die there. The way things were going, he couldn't afford to, and he knew it. That's why the TV bothered him. He'd worked all his life, and all he ended up with was less than he'd started with. That and a box to beam his family images of a life none of them could afford. So there we sat, sweating in front of reruns of Gilligan's Island. The millionaire and his wife were on, sipping cocktails out of coconut shells, and pretending to want off this godforsaken island, and Granddad just got up and left. I remember thinking that he really had to go, since he didn't even wait for a commercial. But when the credits rolled, and he didn't return, I got curious. Granddad was out in the front yard, barely outlined by the weak light spilling from the house, tamping green tomato stakes into the hard ground, pacing out the distance between them. He didn't notice me until he'd finished, and even then he didn't explain, only mussed my hair and muttered, "Never you mind," as if I'd been brave enough to ask what he was doing. Before dawn, Granddad fired up the backhoe, which belched to life with a loud pop of diesel and soot, so loud it even woke the teenagers. Meemaw ran out screaming something about azaleas, but it was too late. The machine's rusty teeth had already snapped them up, depositing the scraggly remains atop the dirt mound rising behind the corn crib. Granddad wielded the backhoe expertly, manipulating the levers that drove the machine's bucket into the earth, then coasting to a stop in front of his wife, who demanded an explanation. News of the groundbreaking filtered down through us kids like sun tea in a jar. Soon the whole house was vibrating with anticipation. For days, we spent our afternoons crowded into the big bay window in the front room, jockeying for space among Meemaw's dusty Hummels. The older boys made a game out of ducking behind the sofa whenever Granddad paused in his labor to glance at the house. We all feared his knack for spotting idle hands. No one wanted to end up like Jim and Kevin, who spent their summer afternoons hunched behind wheelbarrows of concrete mix, then sat sunburnt and sullen at the dinner table, wincing in red-shouldered pain as they passed the buttered peas. It took a week for Granddad to finish construction, mainly because the deep end had to be trenched out by hand. He made Jim measure the corners 3 times. They had to be as perfectly square as the pools we knew from the Brady's television vacations, each turquoise rectangle rimmed in toothpaste white, every glittering pool a jewel in a chain stretching from Adams County to California. He wanted his grandchildren to turn mermaid, our thin fingers waterlogged white. He longed to smell chlorine and zinc oxide on our skin when he tucked us in, that faintly chemical tang of America's arrived. Once he deemed the pit large enough, Granddad formed up the sides with plywood and covered them with quickcrete that crept across the bottom of the pool. This part of the process was fraught with argument. Granddad scolded Kevin for mixing it too thin. He snatched the wheelbarrow away from Jim, said he was doing it wrong. The rest of us stood silent, feeling really lucky we weren't involved, until the job was finished and Jim and Kevin got to carve their names in the cool cement edge of the shallow end, crowning their autographs with a big Z for Zorro. I was so jealous I could spit. After the concrete set, Granddad anchored an aluminum ladder to the bottom with bricks that had fallen out of the barn foundation. Then someone turned on the hose. I don't remember why we never thought to smooth or sand anything first. I guess the heat pickled our brains. We all just stood watching the hose writhe against the sides, splashing the dry cement elephant gray. Meemaw kept saying that we shouldn't get our hopes up. It wouldn't hold water. The yard was too thirsty. But once the concrete soaked through, a dusty liquid began to pool in the far corner, and she had to eat crow. We all changed into our bathing suits hours before dinner, but the pool was only half full by the time Meemaw set out a dessert of stale Oreos, which we flung like frisbees and rescued from the tall grass. Granddad poured in half a jug of Clorox and said we could all get in early if we used the ladder. No horseplay, no funny business. Anyone who jumped or dove would be banished to the front room with no TV. Of course, Jim cannonballed. He still says that he would have spent 1,000 nights alone with that dead screen just to be the first one in, the freshest egg. The swimming pool cut our feet to shreds, but no one cared. We got in after breakfast and stayed in after dark, begging for just a few more minutes whenever Meemaw turned off the porch light, scattering the moths. "Marco! Polo!" Our voices rang through the cedars. Jim and Kevin took turns playing lifeguard. But they were also the two who started the whirlpool when Meemaw wasn't looking. They banked the corners like dolphins, soaking the grass, sweeping the rest of us along in a giggling tangle of sunburnt arms and inflatables. You had to kick strategically to avoid a scrape on the sides, and someone was always getting a noseful of water or a strawberry or a bruise from a green walnut, which we threw like tennis balls. Something just bad enough to cry about would happen, and Meemaw would yell out the screen door that we had 5 seconds to knock it off. 4, 3, 2. Our grandparents never got in the pool, at least not with us. Meemaw changed into a white bathing suit after her soaps, put the toddlers down for naps, and sunned in her plastic lawn chair, chain-smoking cools. Granddad spent his afternoons doing small engine repair or reseeding the dead grass in a futile battle against the drought. A rumor developed among us that he avoided the pool because he'd taken a fall through an icy stock pond. We mentally transposed his face onto little Harry Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life until we believed it was a documentary. That's why he wanted us to swim, insisted Jim, to arm us against undertow and grant us the fins he never grew. Only those whose weak bladders sent us fumbling for the toilet after midnight ever learned the truth. Granddad swam. You could see him through the bubbled glass of the upstairs bathroom window, standing barefoot at the water's edge, wielding a net made of Meemaw's torn nylons. With a pair of bug-eyed goggles strapped around his balding head, he lifted out the dead beetles, combing the water clean. Next came calisthenics, some jerky sequence half-remembered from a Charles Atlas record, performed at 33 1/3 RPM to spare his knees. He rolled his shoulders like a boxer, his elbows folded into mighty right angles. In these moments there was a trace of the high school hero about him, the sinewy vigor of brass trophies and felted varsity letters. He stretched his arms toward the star-studded sky, laced his fingers, here's the church, here's the steeple, and just as you thought, oh, he's going to die, he dove, piercing the surface like a javelin. Granddad swam slowly, turning his head to breathe. His legs churned just under water, stirring up a small wake that followed him up and down the pool. Each stroke sent a hail of peeper frogs bounding into the grass. Drowsy chickens bit at half-drowned moths. And onward went Granddad, his farmer-tanned arms carving arcs in the mist rising off the water. Soon July was stealing June. People started letting themselves say drought aloud, and there was widespread worry about putting enough hay up for the winter. But our swimming pool was always surrounded by a lush clover halo, so green it seemed spray-painted, a lone patch of golf course glory in a bunker of dust. Of course it attracted wildlife. First our dinner chickens ambled over to snap at crickets, their guts and gizzards mysteriously transforming wiry legs and antennae to white and dark meat. Then came the rabbit family, who darted under the porch whenever we banged through the screen door. Drowned possums and raccoons were fished out with the skimmer, each tiny jaw a saw-toothed leer. In retrospect, someone should have noted the slow increase in size, the gradual ascent through the animal kingdom. But none of us knew the neighbor man had horses until his gray mare wound up dead in our swimming pool. Jim was the first one to find her. Her white belly ballooned in the deep end, forcing the head and neck under water, where the mane waved like gray seaweed. One rheumy eye stood open. Her teeth were buttered corn. Granddad strode out of the house, snatched away the stick Jim was using to poke the body, and shooed the rest of us back from the water. Then he gritted his jaw and swore. Those of us who saw his midnight swims watched the math in his eyes. How long it had been since he went back to bed, versus when the horse must have fallen into the pool. It was awful to picture the animal as it must have been, alone in the dark water, nostrils flaring, hooves slashing for purchase on the concrete until, exhausted, she gave herself up for drowned. Each of us privately agonized that we'd left the gate in the woods standing open, the one that separated Granddad's land from the neighbor's pasture. But nobody had the guts to go check if it was, lest we arouse suspicion. Instead, we all wondered aloud how we hadn't heard a splash or a whinny in the night. Later, Jim said that he had dreamt of horses galumphing down red cliffs, the Lone Ranger and Silver aiming six guns at a lemonade sky. Meemaw already called the neighbor man. He came grinding down our access road in a big black Ford and a real cowboy hat. A half-grown hound leapt out of the flatbed before the truck came to a complete stop, then pointed at the horse corpse, nose and tail spellbound straight. "Well, that's no good," said the neighbor man, cocking his finger at the mare as he stepped out of the cab. Job done, the hound shambled over to drink from the deep end, his tongue a pink ladle. Jim laughed first, a high pubescent bark that echoed off the barn. Then the neighbor man did too, And we all had permission, even Granddad, who was so grateful he accepted a cigarette, even though he didn't smoke. "It's just one of those things," said the neighbor man. And then he explained how Miss Sugar couldn't see in the dark. Moonblind, he called it. She probably just figured she'd waded into a stock pond. Maybe she thought there was still a shore to reach, a way to march up out of the water, shake it off, and get back to eating that grass there. "I tell you," he said, "that's the greenest grass I've seen in months. No wonder she came over here. All we got left is last year's hay. Anyway, it's a shame about the pool. Seems like it was a nice setup for the kids." He looked right at us then, and we older kids were suddenly conscious of our Hawaiian print swimsuits, of the orange vinyl floaties clinging to the twins' chubby arms, all ridiculous next to the bloated, floating Miss Sugar. Granddad made our communal apologies, touching the cigarette to his lips every now and then, but mostly just letting it burn. The dead horse bobbed slightly in the deep end, and maybe it was because September was just a few weeks away, or maybe he was fed up with Meemaw's complaints about the water bill, but either way, Granddad and the neighbor man decided that they'd fill in the swimming pool instead of trying to haul the dead mare up out of the water. Granddad piloted the backhoe, clods of grassy clay clinging to the machine's steel maw as it swung through the air. The neighbor man stood nearby, supervising. For the first 15 loads of dirt, it didn't seem like much was happening. Rocks and silt swirled to the bottom of the swimming pool, making the horse bob like a foundered canoe. Eventually, the water thickened, sucking the mare's body down until only the point of her shoulder jutted out of the muck, dingy and white like old bone. The neighbor man found the biggest rock he could, a monster slab of shale that had to be pried out from under the machine shed with crowbars. Jim and Kevin were drafted as additional pallbearers, and together the four men swung the rock out over the water, aiming for Miss Sugar's bare shoulder, which sank under the weight, burbling as it disappeared. I remember we had one of the chickens for dinner, even though it wasn't Sunday. Granddad went out with his hatchet, and Meemaw fired up the oven, and we all changed out of our swimsuits to watch Hawaii 5-0. I'm pretty sure the special food was meant as a consolation prize for losing the pool, but the kitchen got so hot, sweat dripped onto our plates, and there was blood in the meat. Thank you, Jess, for allowing us to read that delightful story. We were sorry for the horse, though. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Ananda Lima. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories, I'll find you. Hold your tongue, boy.